Thank you. I'm going to bring it back to the council for a couple of comments, and then I think if we move it on to the SSC, we're going to get a perhaps a repeat of some of them. Dave?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of the comments, I think that Ron has hit it pretty much on the head, and I particularly was pleased that he expanded upon what Dave Gaithel said yesterday. I was going to do so yesterday, but Dave expressed himself so well that I didn't. But we discussed this at length last night. Mark Gibson was involved in the discussion. And it's inescapable that right now we've got a food web that is thoroughly distorted. The distortion, we may not have overfishing occurring at this time, but the distortion is the result of past overfishing decades ago. And now what we have is low abundance and productivity of desirable species, but that new paradigm has become stable, and it's devilishly hard to change it. The stability is being maintained through a series of feedback that seem to center upon the spiny dogfish as being this key character, the key player in maintaining a much different paradigm than what we need to manage for. We're going to continue with low productivity and with a low abundance of species that are desirable as long as we allow this feedback loop to produce stability. I think that what we need to do is be breaking that paradigm, that stability, that feedback loop. We may have to actually overfish dogfish in order to take them out of the equation to allow this to happen. And then at that point, we need to be ready to combine our management plans. We're going in too many directions at once. We're not making any progress because we're wrapped up with the single species management that's occupying all of our time and going nowhere. And as Dave mentioned yesterday, it's been going nowhere for four decades. And we've got to get these plans combined into one ecosystem-based management plan so we can get some kind of efficiency in what we do. And at that point, then perhaps we can, instead of being like somebody who's trying to develop a shopping center in an undeveloped area and having to do an EIS for the pine trees and one for the maple trees and one for the bugs and one for the birds, we could just do an ecosystem management plan that we update with one action and not get wrapped up in what we're doing. One of the things that I really like what's happening right now is this: it's become evident that we've got at least three plans, the scallop, the groundfish, and the habitat plan that now have to work together, being forced to work together. We should have been doing that a long time ago. But we need to place this in some kind of a more rational and Mark has a lot of good information on that that he brought up yesterday afternoon, and I don't know if he wants to expand upon that. He knows a lot more about the bioenergetics of it than I do, but I just don't see how we can continue as David was saying yesterday, doing the same thing, expecting a different outcome. Thank you.
Mark, did you have a follow-up on that?
Good thing I was pulling up that paper while Dave was talking. I'll just read a statement out of a paper by Jeremy Colley and John Steele. An increase in cod within the piscivore guild would require decreases in other piscivores, such as the Elasma rex, winter skater, spiny dogfish. And the science is already there in terms of, it's already saying what we're hearing, that there will have to be active restructuring of the community out there in order for it to return to its cod dominated food web. So I think the information is already available. It's a legal problem. You can't deliberately overfish components of the ecosystem to get to the desired end.
Bill Karp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few comments in response to the various comments that I've heard. The first is, And I regret that I wasn't here yesterday because a lot of this discussion certainly took place then. Mm. Clearly, the council is faced with some very difficult challenges, and that the issues before the council are severely affecting the livelihood of the fishing communities in a way that is perhaps unprecedented. Furthermore, the information that's coming forward, these decisions are being based on science, and so from the science community, we're bringing the news, which is unwelcome news, and we understand that. I continue to stand behind the integrity of the science, and I believe that all of the evaluations of the science support that perspective. Nevertheless, the science is uncertain, and there is an extra burden of proof on us from the science side to explain and to communicate what it is that we are doing and how we're doing it, and what are the sources of uncertainty, and how we might proceed to address those sources of uncertainty. And I think John mentioned yesterday that we're planning to have a forum in November, which will be the first step in addressing this broad challenge of better communicating our science to everybody who's interested, and of listening to all of you and whoever chooses to attend this forum to help us to figure out how to do a better job of communicating and of listening. So that's the first thing that I really wanted to say to you. With response to this particular discussion, a couple of things I think are important. One is the discussion that Ron started, and then Dave and Mark engaged in relative to the factors within the ecosystem that are changing, and what action we might be able to take to recognize that in some kind of active management. There's no question that we need to look at this from an ecosystem perspective, and that the center and the region and the council are engaging in that process, although it's moving inexorably slowly, partially because of the demands that are placed on all of us to look at these single species assessments and provide advice in that manner. But you can see, an example of how that played out in the herring assessment, where we were able to look at a broader range of ecosystem factors and take those into account in looking at the various factors that will affect natural mortality and incorporating that in the assessment. So there's an example of a small step in that direction. I caution all of us to be mindful that the outcome of this process may not be what we think it's going to be. There's no question that there's a very high abundance of elasmobranchs in the system now, and that there's legitimate concerns and a legitimate perspective that if we manage that part of the fish community in a particular way, there'll be a clear cause and effect, if you will, in terms of recovery of the groundfish stocks. We need to look at that very carefully, and we are doing some work in that regard. And I'm going to ask Jason Link to come and talk to the council at some point soon about what he has been doing. But it's a much more complex issue than it first appears to be, and that's part of the challenge of how to deal with that broader perspective. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It does mean that we need to be very mindful of where we're going and how we're stepping in that direction. The second thing that Ron raised was the survey question, and I'm grateful to Ron for clarifying at least his perspective on the value of the Bigelow surveys and the quality of the data that comes from the surveys. Because in my view, at least coming from another part of the country and seeing how things played out there, in the Northeast, a huge amount of work was done between the agency and the industry to develop the new survey gear and to match that with the Bigelow. That the outreach was huge, and the recognition of input from the fishers and from the gear manufacturers was unprecedented. That doesn't mean that this survey is not without its challenges and that there are places where we could make things better. And we have been looking at how best to move forward and partner with the industry with some kind of industry-based survey, called a side-by-side survey, whether it's called a supplementary survey of some kind, which would require some intercalibration. And this idea of working with the industry to look at the feasibility of an industry-based survey for flatfish is one of several candidate ideas that we have on the table and that we're looking at. So I will be coming back to the council and sharing
our perspective as these ideas develop and seeking input from the council and from the industry on that particular aspect. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Bill. I have Tom Dempsey, then Doug Grout, then we are going to take a break and come back and get the SSC presentation. Tom.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I guess in light of this ecosystem discussion, and I think it's a good one, anybody wants to talk about what we should do with Dogfish and how we can rebalance the ecosystem, I'm very happy to have that conversation. But in light of the ecosystem approach, I want to maybe take a second crack at answering the earlier question on the consumption model that was brought up. And I think the simpler answer is yes. If we rebuild groundfish, they have to eat something, and they'll be eating herring. So we can expect consumption. In the event that we ever do rebuild these groundfish stocks, we can expect consumption to go up. And I take Jim's point. It's very complicated. This eats that eats this. But it all comes back down to the forage base. So I think those consumption models can be expected to go up. And I think the flip side of that is I don't think we can rebuild groundfish, some of these depleted groundfish stocks, without something, without forage for them to consume. So I think there is a tight ecosystem-based link that we're already seeing here. If we rebuild these groundfish stocks, the simple answer is consumption is going to go up. So maybe that's an oversimplified approach, but I think that's the nut of what we're talking about in terms of some of these ecosystem interactions. Leads me to a second question, and we heard yesterday about the acoustic survey taking a year off. And I'd sort of like to get, Jim, your thoughts on where we are with the acoustic survey. So my understanding, it was an approach or an augmented approach, supplemental approach that everyone from the industry to management, stock assessment scientists recognize that because of the nature of the pelagic nature of this stock, an acoustic survey should better allow us to estimate. Now, having sat at some of those data meetings, the acoustic survey shows some pretty troubling trends on George's for this stock. For their own reasons, this was sort of taken out, I think primarily because it didn't agree with the underlying model or the results of the underlying model that was used. This was taken out of the assessment and run as a sensitivity analysis. But I guess I wonder if, where are we going with the acoustic survey? Everybody wanted it. It was going to happen. We ran it. We didn't like the answer. Didn't jive with this model that admittedly is dependent on a 2008 year class, and now we're taking a year off. So could you explain where we are with that tool, why it wasn't used this go-around, and whether we're essentially scrapping the program?
I see Bill's hand up.
Bill has his hand up. I could say something. Bill, do you want to speak first? Or?
Why
don't
you start?
Okay. I didn't sit in on all of the working group meetings, so I don't know the exact details of the acoustic survey and its fit in terms of, the rest of the surveys and so forth. But the working group took a close look at this, and there were questions about the initial, I think it was the early time points in the acoustic survey were very high, and then there was a large drop that stayed fairly consistently low relative to those two initial high points. And I don't think that made any sense relative to any of the other information that was out there. And when I think that, that's my kind of shallow understanding of this. As I said, I wasn't on the working group. And in general, acoustic surveys should work, and I think in other parts of the world they are being used to assess species such as herring. So I know people are scratching their heads, why isn't it working in our system? And there were questions raised about whether the stock of herring, the herring survey is not conducted over the entire range of, so there's always the question of whether the fish have moved or not, because if you always do the survey in one place and the fish are moving in and out, then that would cause the survey not to make sense over time. So they examined that, and I don't think they found evidence of any big changes in the migration. So that didn't explain it away. And but I know that people, you know, are trying to understand why it isn't working. And it had something to do with the spatial scale of the survey relative to the fish population and this real lack of fit in those initial time points. Now, I believe Bill would be able to add to that, as he has quite a bit of experience with acoustic surveys and so.
Thank you, Jim and Tom. It's true that I've worked with acoustics and the acoustic assessments of pollock in the Bering Sea, and I have a general knowledge of how well acoustics works in various parts of the world, for herring amongst other species, so I'm equally concerned. I think it's a powerful tool, and I think we need to figure out how to make it work. There are probably some problems with survey design and timing. I haven't had the opportunity personally to look at this very carefully. One of the reasons for suspending the survey in 2014 is to actually give us enough time to look very carefully at how we're doing this and what the shortcomings might be so that we can improve the design for future years. So this suspension of the survey should not be seen as a cancellation. It should be seen really as a need just to take a time out so that we can figure out how to make it work better.
Great.
Just a quick follow-up. Are we defining the acoustic survey working as matching the signal that's coming out of the model? I mean, it seems like had the acoustic survey demonstrated the upward trend over the last few years that the model projects, that it would be adopted and included. What's the definition of the acoustic survey working? The acoustic survey worked. It demonstrated a signal that happens not to jive with the model. So what we're looking for out of this this powerful new technology is for it to essentially support or duplicate something that we're already doing, and if it provides a different signal, then it's clearly not working. That wasn't my understanding with where we were going with the acoustic survey.
Let me try and respond. There are obviously a number of different sources of data that inform the model. And so if one of those sources is an outlier, it's particularly difficult to reconcile. But that's by itself not a reason to throw it out. It's a reason to look more carefully at what it's telling us. And that may be part of the problem, that we're not looking carefully enough. For example, and harping back to pollock, which is a very different animal, the bottom trawl survey and the acoustic survey different parts of the population structure, different sizes and ages. And I don't know, again, being new to how this has been done here, to what extent that's true with the pelagic versus demersal surveys here and how that's taken into account. But it's an example of the kinds of things that we would want to look at to not look for a match per se in biomass estimates, but to look to see exactly what kind of information this is providing and how it can be included in the.
Doug Grout. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a piece of information I might be able to provide to Tom. And then I had a question for Dr. Jim about a particular part of the assessment. But when we received these the assessment, both at ASMSC via the section and then at the committee, one of the questions that we provided asked was about this 2008 year class, and whether they were whether it was being picked up every place, because there was some rather large year class, and the response that we've gotten from the assessment biologist was that it is picked up very clearly and strongly in the multiple trawl surveys that were analyzed and put into the model, as well as the catch at age. But it was not picked up in the acoustic survey. And so that was one of the reasons that I think they were reluctant to use it in the assessment, because it was showing up in so many, that year class was showing up in so many of the different pieces of data, but not in that. why it is, I don't know, and that's, I think, that's a good task for the Science Center. The question I had for Jim was with our new estimate of maximum sustainable yield. I understand why it declined so much, and it makes total sense if you can bring that up to me. The increased M clearly is driving that, as well as you said, the new model. It makes total sense to me as a scientist, or at least a former one. But the thing that struck me, and I think this was brought up at one of our meetings here, is that we now have a estimate of the current maximum sustainable yield that's significantly below even our most recent long-term average since the 80s, and clearly way below our average catches if you go through the entire landing series. And, you know, my recollection from school that maximum sustainable yield was a long-term equilibrium. But it surprises me that we can have catches consistently over a 40-year time series that exceed the current value, and so I was of MSY, and so I was wondering if either the assessment scientists or the peer review scientists or even yourself might be able to enlighten me and the rest of the council as to how we can be continually harvesting over maximum sustainable yield and still not have a resource that's overfished and overfishing isn't occurring.
Yeah, I fortunately not because I'm smart, but John DeRoba had the foresight to provide me with some answers that this would come up, and his explanation was that the this is largely driven by the current herring growth rate and the natural mortality rate. The growth rate is lower now, and the fish have smaller weight per size, weight per age, and the natural mortality rate is higher. So the MSY that currently exists is consistent with the new perception of the fish, as he calls it, being skinnier and dying faster. And that leads to the lower MSY value that has come out. And if you look at the biomass trends anyway that were occurring since the mid-90s, the biomass had been declining for about 10 years until this recent pulse of recruitment. So in fact, the stock biomass declining, and that was something I remember the SARC panel. So they did consider this in their evaluation. And just to correct one point about the acoustic survey that I think you made incorrectly, John indicated that the acoustic survey did pick up an indication of the 2008 year class.
That's not what I heard.
Right, okay.
We were going to go to a break now. Dave, you got a quick question?
Yeah, I just had two quick ones. One on slide 17 on the herring. I don't see the discussion of the mixing rate. We're now fully harvesting the fish in Area 2, so the mixing rate is pretty important. And I was just wondering if the assessment didn't discuss that or if the SSC is going to deal with it. And that's bullet 3 on that slide.
Yeah, I think that there wasn't a whole lot of focus on this during the stock assessment, and they were, at least what I heard, they were looking more in terms of the work that was presented to them, which was for the entire stock. And I know that the way the assessment is done does not match the way you manage herring, which where you have these sub-areas and allocations and so forth. And I think they viewed that more as at the next stage when the council gets to it, those discussions will occur, but they didn't really get to that in detail, in any detail.
Okay, my second one is on Yellowtail, slide 23. And I just wanted to point out to people, if you look at the time period around 1951 to 1956, 57, this was a similar period with a very warm water regime. And then you go look at the 2000s, and I mean, to me, this is your smoking gun for southern New England yellowtail flounder. Remember, in the 1950s, there were essentially no fishing restrictions of any kind. The catch dropped to levels, very, very low levels, presumably with people actively fishing for whatever they could catch. In the 2000s, they've been actively constrained by fisheries management to low levels. But the two numbers look very similar. So I think going forward here, at least with yellowtail, one of the things we're going to have to start doing is comparing warm water regimes and cold water regimes and looking for what our biomass reference points should be under two different scenarios. Because clearly in the 1950s, this stock dropped to a very, very low level. And, you know, it's the same regime. So, you know, I'm grateful for this slide being in here because it illustrates the issue with southern New England yellowtail, and I imagine with Georges Bank yellowtail. So I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that or not.
No, I'm not prepared to comment on that. And out of fairness, I mentioned John DeRoba doing a lot of work on herring. I just want to acknowledge Larry Alade was the lead assessment scientist on the flounder assessment. Also did an excellent job.
Thank you, Jim. We'll take a 10-minute break. We'll come back at 10:10, and we will get into the SSC report.